You've got a Bible, turn with me to Job chapter 9. I'm actually just reading through my list to make sure I didn't forget too much. I think I'm okay. About 11 years ago, I wrestled with God. Circumstances are fairly irrelevant. In fact, if I told you the circumstances, it might even seem silly to you. In fact, that seems to be one of the common elements about wrestling with God, maybe why it's hard to talk about. It's not necessarily the degree of pain, it's the degree of the darkness that accompanies it. In fact, I often have reflected on that Luke 4 passage where Satan had tempted Jesus and then went away and said, I will come back at a different time. Seemingly, he knew that there was a timing element that goes on in our wrestling. It's not just the severity of the issue, it's the timing of the issue. And I remember as I wrestled with God, never was his existence in doubt. That was not the question, nor was ever his power in doubt. I've never doubted his might, his ability, his strength. But the question that was sort of at the center of it all was, does he love me? You know, I don't know how you could phrase it, is he good? But it was not just that generic sort of thing, it was, what about me? And probably many of us have been there at some point, which makes Job so important. Because it's one of the few books in the Bible that lands us right in the middle of a scene of a man wrestling with God. And unlike me, who hesitates to kind of pull back all the curtain and say, now I'm going to let you see all the ugliness of what that looked like, most of us hide that a little bit. Job, it's there for us to see. In all of its shocking questions and all of his doubts, we get to journey with this man through his wrestling and see not only how he does it, but how God responds. And for that reason, Job is a massively important book to us. And I trust, even as we continue to walk through it today, that as we go from chapter 8 to 10, and we still won't bring resolution. Chapter 10 is not a moment where everything gets simple and clear and neat, but we will continue to see a man who wrestles with God, and we will continue to have the hope that if we continue to wrestle with God, there comes a chapter 42. There comes a moment where God does bring resolution to that. I think one of the great ironies of the book of Job is that it's precisely at the moment that his friends arrive on the scene that Job actually melts down. I don't know quite what we do with that, but up to the end of chapter 2, despite all of the difficulty and all of the pain and all of the suffering, he still is able to fix his eyes on God and say, I trust him, I trust him. And then three friends arrive, and it is meltdown. And for the next almost 30 chapters, Job wrestles with partly God, but partly what his friends have to say about the Lord. And we're right in the middle of that now this morning as we come to chapter 8, where the second friend begins to speak. He arrives at this moment and says some things that maybe we don't expect. Because if you remember back to last week, if you were here, the first friend spoke. It began with traces of compassion. It got more confusing as Eliphaz spoke more. And then we saw Job respond saying, why won't you just look at me? I need comfort. I don't need a lecture. Now that's the paraphrase, but if you're to read through his response, you'll see a man broken, just needing the comfort of some friends. And so we might expect, now the second friend might arrive on the scene, having heard all that and saying, oh, I get it. Job just needs me to show up, to be compassionate, to point him to the Lord. And instead, we get this. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, how long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? There's sort of an irony to that, because in chapter 6, verse 26, Job said, it seems like you're treating my words, he's speaking to his friends, like they're just empty, hot air. You're not even hearing what I'm saying. And Bildad arrives on the scene and goes, you're exactly right. Everything you said, it's just useless, Job. It is empty, hot air. There's a reason we're treating you that way. And then he goes on, and for the next, 21 or so verses, he responds again to Job. I'm gonna kind of use just a brief outline to his response so we kind of see what he's going to do. He's essentially going to remind Job in verse 2 and 3 of the central issue that he sees going wrong in Job's life, which is this. You are perverting the justice of God. All right, that's verse 3. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert the right? In Bildad's mind, in Eliphaz's mind, in all their minds, this is the central question. Job, you must have done something that's wrong. Because God is sovereign, therefore everything that happens is connected to him. And God is just, so that everything that happens must be right. And so Job, if you're suffering, this is a very simple math formula, Job. You've earned it. If you're suffering, you did something bad. If you're blessed, you've done something good. Job, this is the inescapable reality of who God is. And Job, anything other than that is a twisting of the justice. That's what that word pervert means. To twist or to bend, to take the justice of God and to just change it into something that it's not. And so Bildad arrives in the scene and says, Job, I know the central issue. You are twisting the very essence of who God is, his justice. And then, for the rest of the chapter, he's going to prove it. Here's what he does. First, he's going to appeal to a logic argument. Then he's going to move on from that and appeal to tradition. And then lastly, he's going to look at some illustrations from nature. So from verse 4 to 7, we have the sound logic. From verse 8 to 10, we have tradition. And then 11 to 19, there's some illustrations from nature around him. And then 20 to 22, he's going to wrap it all up in a nice, neat bow and say, Job, there it is. There's the conclusion. It's inescapable. So let's have a quick look. And then from chapter 9 and 10, Job will respond to this. He starts with kind of the logic, which follows a number of if statements. If this, then that, right? It sounds like logic. That's how we kind of present logic. If, then, therefore, that's the language of logic. And so Bildad comes to him, and here's where he starts. If your children have sinned against him, it's like, oh, Bildad, don't go there. But he can't stop himself. He sees nothing wrong with going there. And we already know the story. Job's 10 children have died at this point. And so Bildad comes along, and here's the logic of it. Your kids have died. They must have sinned. They got what they deserved. He has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. Job, it's inescapable. It's the simplest logic in the world. If, he says, you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, then surely he will rouse himself for you, restore your rightful habitation, and though your beginning was small, your later days will be very great. There it is. There's the logic of this, Job. The reason you're suffering is because you've sinned. Case in point, your kids who are now dead, they must have sinned. That's why they've suffered. Their sin must be very great. And so, Job, you're attached to this, but Job, if you were to seek God, then everything would be fixed. That's the logic. Through it are some incredibly disturbing things. Things that as I read and as I see the connections, you're like, oh, wow. I'm actually amazed Job just doesn't either walk away at this point, never to talk to these guys again, or do what many of us would have been inclined to do, which is just punch him in the face. Bildad actually uses the very word that shows up in chapter 1 when in verse 5. If you will seek God. Literally it means, Job, if you were to get up early in the morning and you were to do the right things, everything would be okay. But you see, in chapter 1, we're already told that's already what Job was doing every morning. He was getting up, seeking the Lord, doing the right things on behalf of his kids. And now Bildad brings that exact answer up. This is Job. Clearly you have messed up. I mean, the implication, do you hear it? Job, your kids died because of you. But Job, good news, my friend. All you need to do is come back to God, and everything will be great. That's the logic of Bildad's argument. Now, he's going to explain why he believes this. Just as Eliphaz did in the last section, he sort of presented what he believed and then sort of explained why. And his explanation was, I just look around at the world and I see it. It's just how the world works. And I had this weird dream, and in the middle of the night, that's what I heard. That was Eliphaz's argument. Bildad's is a little bit different. So he says this. Verse 10, inquire, please, of bygone ages and consider what our fathers have searched out. For we are but of yesterday and know nothing, and our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you in other words out of their understanding? In other words, Job, our life is so short, that's the fleeting shadow part, that we don't have enough time to gain enough wisdom to be able to address this. Like, life's just too short, Job. We won't be able to make sense of this. Thankfully, Job, we don't have to. We can look back at what others who have lived have said. We can lean on their tradition and understanding. And Job, I'm telling you, everyone who has ever lived knows what I've just said is true. You can trust it. It's tradition. It's that important caution. It's not that tradition's bad. It's just not that tradition is all there is. Right? We know that. Some traditions are good. They're wise. They are insightful. But it's not the full thing there is to say about a thing. Bildad comes and he's just got that. Job, there's tradition. Unwilling to consider Job's situation at all. Then he moves on into three illustrations from nature from verse 11 to 19. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but they essentially go along these lines. Job, if I look at papyrus, it grows quickly, but it depends on being rooted in a marsh. And if the water dries up, the papyrus dies. And Job, that seems to me to be a parallel to a person who sort of seems to have prosperity, but then the water dries up and they die. And Job, that person is a godless person, having forsaken the Lord. That's his parallel. So if you look at verse 13, this, the papyrus that keels over because there's not enough water, that's the path, Job, of a person who is godless, who has forgotten God. And forgotten God doesn't mean you like forgetting where your keys are. It means you just don't factor him into life. You set him aside. You live life as though he didn't exist. And you hear again what he's saying to Job. Job, you're the papyrus that's done this. So Job, here's the implication. You have become godless, and you aren't factoring God into your life. Which is, again, one of those strange ironies of the book. If there is anyone in the story who has not forgotten God, who's factoring God into the equation, it's Job. And yet the friends come along, and it's just nice and neat and tidy. They put a bow on it, so to speak. It's so clear and tidy to them. I love this one quote. Let's see if I can find it here quickly. I probably won't be able to. I've got a great quote, and I'm not going to share it with you. But it's something along the lines of, you know, we have these great answers, and you know, it's all nice and neat. The only problem is that most of our answers are wrong. When they come in that sort of mechanical sort of sense, A plus B always equals C, Job. Your kids have died. This is how it works, Job. I watched a papyrus. It dies when there's no water, Job, and you... You put your confidence in stuff, Job. That's his point. You don't lean against your house because it won't stand. Job, I'm now accusing you, Job, of putting your hope in your stuff. And again, if ever there was a person who is not wired that way, it's Job. Even when his friends come along, and the whole appeal is, Job, seek God and he'll give you your stuff back. You hear that, don't you? Be wary if anyone ever comes to you. And the appeal, the sense of the appeal to you is you can get stuff if you follow God. Like, oh, I hope the caution flags just go up. Because God is not a butler to bring us stuff. But that's his friends. Job, if you seek God, he'll give you stuff back. And Job's, again, the one guy in the book that is utterly disinterested in the stuff. Not once do you hear him mourning the loss of camels or flocks. It's, how am I right with God? The last little example that Bildad uses from nature is this one of a lush plant, verse 16 to 19, that he describes as a plant that puts out its roots deep into the water, or into the soil, sorry. And even though things get hard, the plant seems to endure. His point seems to be not a negative one now, like the first two. Job, here's how you fail. It seems to be, Job, here's how you succeed. Like if you were a plant to put down deep, deep roots, almost like that Psalm 1, blessed is the man, right? But Job, clearly you are not that man because you've wilted. Your life is all drooped and fallen over. That's his argument. He concludes in verse 20, behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers. Let me just translate that so we know exactly what he's saying. If a righteous man hits suffering, God will come to his aid. God will not cause an evil man to prosper. And if an evil man or woman prospers, God will not come to their aid. That's what he's saying. That's what that verse means. So Job, you tell me which man you are. You've hit suffering. Has God come to your aid? And his answer is, it doesn't even have to be said. His answer is no, God hasn't. So Job, now you know who you are. Then verse 21 and 22, this little glimmer of hope that the friends always bring near the end of their speeches. After all that pain they inflict, here's the hope. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more. So Job, if you just listen to us, admit how sinful you are, that you earned all this, that God is just, that you're a sinner, seek him again, hey. When all this is done, we'll be laughing about this together. Big smiles on our face. That's Bildad's words of comfort. Job is going to respond to this for two chapters. Again, it's sort of like last time, where part of it will be a response to the friends, part of it a response to God. But it's just sort of a reminder to us of how badly the friends are missing the mark here. Chuck Swindoll tells a story, actually, about this very thing. He tells the story of a man whose wife is celebrating a birthday. I won't pick on anyone. I know there's a couple of birthdays, but we'll save that for second service. But wish Joel a happy birthday when you see him. So he says to his wife, what do you want for your birthday? And she says, I'd love to be six again. So he's like, awesome, I can. The next morning, he gets up early. He's making waffles and whipped cream and wakes her up, feeds her this delicious, kid-friendly birthday breakfast, says we're going to a theme park. Puts her on every ride. I mean, by the end of it, she's starting to turn green. Then for lunch, takes her to McDonald's. There's a Big Mac, fries, and a chocolate milkshake. And then in the afternoon, they go to the theater, and there's the popcorn and the pop and the M&Ms, the whole thing. He gets her home, and he thinks he has just done such a great job. He has given her six again. And she's sort of like still kind of queasy from all the weird food she's just eaten. And he turns to her. It's like, how did you love your day of being six again? I meant a size six. I don't know. You can blame Chuck Swindoll for that one. That's pretty much as far off as what Bildad's done. You see that, right? Job just needed a friend to bring him comfort, and all Bildad's done is come along and brought more and more pain. He's added to the mix that Job is already wrestling with. More fuel not to bring comfort, but to bring pain. Job will now respond, and here's what Job says in response, chapter 9, verse 1. Job answered and said, truly I know that it is so. Now, what is the antecedent of it? The antecedent of it is this description of the justice of God. He's saying, Bildad, I know. I know that's who God is. I know it. In fact, that is precisely the problem. Job is not clueless of this. This is the central issue that he's wrestling with, and you see what he says next. But how can a man be made right before God? It's almost like the friends have asked this question. They did it in chapter 4, verse 17. They'll come back to it in chapter 15. They ask this sort of question of how can you be right before God, Job? But it's almost like Job's coming along and saying, but you aren't even understanding the depth of the question that you have asked. It's more significant than you even realize. How can anyone be right before God? And if we can't, then where are we left? From chapter 9 on, now Job's going to wrestle with this a little bit. And here's how he does it. He imagines a courtroom. I say imagine because I don't actually think he actually expected that God was ever going to be in a courtroom situation the way he quite envisions. But from verse 3 of chapter 9 on, the language is all courtroom language. The words, the verbs he uses, if we could understand Hebrew and understand the words he picks, we would understand he is envisioning that he's in a courtroom with God, bringing sort of a legal challenge against God. That's how he's going to kind of picture this scene. And I think, although this is what I think he's doing, there is a legal precedent in the ancient world that if you are charged with a crime and your accuser does not tell you what the crime is, it is your right to take them to court and to sue them, not for money, but basically to force them to have to reveal what the crime is. And this is Job's problem. It's like, I don't understand why what's happening to me is happening. I wish I could take God to court and force him to tell me, but there's a problem. If you were to take someone to court in the ancient world, it would be settled in one of two ways. Now, one way is going to sound pretty familiar to us. The other way is going to sound a little bit weird. So let's start with the familiar one. The first one is you would both come and you would present your cases, and whoever is silenced first loses. So basically, if you're presenting a case and you do a really good job and the other person has no response, there's silence, you win. That's the one way. The other way is you would wrestle. Like physically, you'd wrestle. And if you win, you win. That's why I say we don't do that so much anymore. Although if you have looked at our legal systems, anyway. Now, if you keep those two things in mind, what Job says through the heart of chapter 9 will make a lot of sense to you. Right? Because now what he's going to consider is this legal courtroom situation. He's going to consider what it would look like for him to engage God in that sort of situation. So just with that backdrop, just listen to what he says. If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer him once in 1,000 times. You see Job's problem? I would get in the courtroom, and he would start asking me questions. And if he asked me 1,000 questions, I couldn't even answer one. I'd be the silent one. I know I'm innocent, but I know I can't respond. Essentially, Job's saying, I would get God in the courtroom, and I would still lose. He goes on. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Job won't even really consider the other option of actually wrestling with God. And then he goes through a description of the strength of God. He removes mountains. They don't know it. He overturns them. He shakes the earth. He commands the sun. This is Job just considering the strength of God. So we get in a courtroom and there's God. Like, how do I stand against the one who brings up the sun and shakes the mountains, who upholds the earth? So he is infinitely wise and infinitely mighty. And so although I wish I could take him to a courtroom to find out what I've done wrong, to contend against him, it's hopeless. And so by the middle of chapter 9, we get this sense again of this growing sense of unease in Job's heart as he contemplates how he's ever going to get to a point of resolution. He hits verse 15, and it's a brilliant little statement. I must appeal for mercy. And in those little moments, do you start to see the glimmer? It's like something inside Job's heart is starting to be able to process what he's seeing. Now, for the rest of chapter 9, he considers some options. The options left to him, let's put it that way. And really, they boil down to three things. Option number one is he could just choose sort of a cheerful type denial from verse 27 to verse 29. So we're kind of jumping through as he's kind of worked through what it would mean to contend against God, and it's a hopeless thing. And he's wrestling, even though I'm innocent, I can't stand against him. And now, verse 27, here's kind of the options left. If I say I will forget my complaint, so he's saying, okay, let's just set all that aside. That's now to say, I can't do that. I can't fight against God. I'm not wiser than God. So I'm never going to get anywhere if I take him to court. So what are the options? Verse 27. I will say, if I say, I'll forget my complaint. I'll put off my sad face and be of good cheer. So he says, here's an option. I could just act as though everything's fine. I'll just smile a lot. I'll cheer myself up. And maybe that's the route to go. And the problem is he quickly pulls it apart. I become afraid of all my suffering, for I know you will not hold me innocent. It's like it's not going to get me anywhere. I can pretend all I want, but it's just pretend. The suffering's still there. The issue of innocence remains. Putting on a smiling face didn't resolve anything. Okay, verse 30. If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, maybe I will just really, really work hard to clean myself up. In other words, maybe my friends are right. Maybe it is just a matter of me just becoming pure and blameless and doing all those things. So he uses images of just sort of the most extreme sort of bathing he can comprehend, using snow and lye. But the problem? You would just plunge me into a pit. My own clothes would abhor me. You would just drop me into a pit of muck. Like, I can't clean me enough. It's not going to work. I can't cheer myself up. I can't just wash myself up. Then this. For he's not a man as I am, that I might answer him, that we should come to a trial together. Again, he's saying that's not going to work. There is no arbitrator between us, which I think a better translation is, oh, that there were. Many of you, if you got a Bible, there'll be a footnote. Would that there were. This is the longing of Job's heart, and he will keep coming back to this. It's like at this point, right in the heart of this, it's the first time this idea has come into his head. Oh, if only there was someone to stand between me and the living, holy God. Because I know I'm a sinner. He's already gone there at the end of chapter 7. I know I'm a sinner. But I know God forgives. And I don't know how those pieces fit together, so I need someone to stand between me and the God that I know. Now, many of us, right away, don't your thoughts just go, oh, we've just come to the gospel. It's richer than that, though, because go and read through chapter 9 sometime and just watch the images that Job brings, the one who treads on the waters. Very, very interesting. The one who performs wonders that cannot be fathomed. Those are the expressions Job is using. And think of Jesus. Who walks in the water, who performs wonders, and people are looking, it's like, we can't understand this, we can't fathom this. And then he says, oh, if there was only a mediator, one to come between us. Now, to be a mediator is a painful thing. You see it through the Old Testament. It's not an unfamiliar thing. In fact, in Ezekiel 22, you see this moment where Ezekiel comes along, and the people are doing sinful things, and God is speaking, and he's giving a description of searching for a man to repair the wall, stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land so that I should not destroy it. Right? If there was one who could stand before this sinful people and me, a holy God, there's the prospect that I would not destroy that. It's the language used to describe Moses in Psalm 106, the one who stood in the breach before God to turn away his wrath from the people. See, the reason being a mediator is a painful thing is because being the mediator, you're sort of the enemy of both sides, aren't you? There's one to stand before a holy God on behalf of a sinful people, people who are sinful, who are not very quick to give up our sin, and a God who will never compromise on his holiness. You realize the problem of being the person in between. I mean, we know it. Someone's going to die. It's the only way that that's possible. And our thoughts go to the Easter account and what Jesus Christ actually did. 1 Timothy 2, 3-6. Read it sometime. It talks about that there is only one mediator between God and man. There's only one. Jesus himself said in John 14, verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. It's the language of mediation. The one who would stand in the gap. And the simple gospel message, if we were to try to summarize it, is God sent his only son. There is one. Scripture foretold it, promised it. He lived the perfect sinless life. He died in our place. He was buried. He rose again. He was seen. And through faith in that action of Jesus Christ, we can be reconciled to God. He will do the work of mediation between a holy God and a sinful people. But I think in that, and in what Job realizes, there's an important note for us that somehow a piece of the wrestling with suffering that we continue to do to this day, that probably many of you are doing at this exact moment, going, I know my suffering, but I don't understand the purpose. I think a piece of it has to be God's redemptive purposes. Somehow God uses our suffering for his redemptive purposes. It's what Paul keeps going back to. It's what the New Testament keeps going back to. And I hate to appeal to it too strongly, but if I was to appeal to experience, I've seen it too many times to discount, where people go through suffering and look and say, I can't deny that God used that to reveal himself to the people around me. There's a redemptive purpose that God has. Okay, we need to hit chapter 10 as Job responds to God. So now again, he goes from that third person speaking to friends. Now he's going to speak to God in chapter 10, verse 1. I loathe my life. I give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. And then from verse 2 on, Job really asks a series of questions as he laments and as he essentially gives us, I think, basically what he would say to God if God was standing right there in front of him. Here's what he's going to say to God. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. And now taking the courtroom language, he's not going to take God to court. Now he's imagining he's the defendant. God, why? Why are you doing this? In fact, that becomes the first question from verse 1 to 3. God, why are you against me? It's clear to Job that God is. He just doesn't understand why. His second question from verse 4 to 7 is this. Why do you watch me? And again, it's that watching in the sense of like being under a security camera. Like we're trying to watch someone do something wrong. That's what Job feels like as God watches him. It's with an intent to find problems with who he is. And so Job's complaint as God watches him is that this always feels to Job like a negative thing. Not a good comforting thing. But God, why do you do this? The third question from verse 8 to 17, why did you create me in the first place? He uses some incredibly beautiful imagery that if we just read it and didn't understand what the question is he's wrestling with, would sound almost like praise from the Psalms, like a potter who's fashioning him, who has made him, and Job is fully aware of that. It's God who's fashioned him with his own hands into something amazing and beautiful. But then he turns around and he envisions that the very one who's fashioned him and spent all that time and energy then takes the pot, just smashes it on the ground. Like, God, why would you do that? Why would you even make me if that's what you're going to do with me in the end? And in the end, he arrives back at his question once again in verse 18 to 22, why don't you kill me? Because Job just can't put the pieces together yet. Let me point out three quick things. Number one, when you're going through your suffering and going through pain, be careful of trying to discern too much of the character of God by your circumstance. That's the inclination of my heart. I don't know if it is of yours. Something goes on, and I see it in Job. He sees what's happening in his life, and he just instantly concludes, this reflects on the character of God. So I'm going to build out from my experience into who God is. At this point, totally unaware that there is another hand involved in this situation. Yes, God is the ultimate cause. We're not ever saying anything different than that. But there is another involved in this, the hand of Satan. We saw it back in chapter 1 and 2. Job doesn't see that part. He doesn't know that scene. It's almost like Job is out on the stage, and behind the stage, there's something going on that I look at the circumstances and then start imagining who God must be without knowing the rest of the story, the other scene, the scene behind the scene. And all through Scripture, there is this consistent this consistent pattern of God as the ultimate cause, the ultimate one, the supreme God, and yet other things going on within his control, but that often come the hand of the evil one. That's Job's problem. That's very likely part of your struggle. And then we try to imagine the character of God based on what we see. Be careful with that. Second thing, if you're wrestling with God, keep going. Don't stop. If there's anything we ought to be learning from the story of Job, it's don't quit. Don't quit if you're in your chapter 10. Just don't stop. I remember this Sunday specifically where my wrestling with God came to its conclusion. Not that I stopped wrestling, it was just one moment I was wrestling with God and couldn't make sense of it, and then the next moment, it was done. And know that God could do that at any time, so don't stop. It would be foolish to quit. Knowing that God in his miraculous power could just choose this moment. He could choose our final song just to bring you to a complete point of peace saying, I'm okay. Doesn't mean the circumstances changed. Mine didn't. But you went from not being able to figure out what you do with those things to being at peace with God. So don't quit wrestling. And lastly, for those of us who are coming alongside, who are the friends, let me just say a couple of quick things to us. And many of you are in this spot. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said this, the first service that one believer owes the other in fellowship consists of listening to them. It's our first service is to listen to one another. He goes on and says, just as the love of God begins in listening to his word. So he brings a parallel. He says, if we say we love God and aren't listening to his word, well, examine your heart. Then he says, if we say we love one another and don't listen to one another, we maybe have a problem. So how do we do that? Well, some practical things, you know. Job says, I just wish they would look me in the eye. That's probably not a bad place to start. Maybe not a bad place to start is by not trying to think through our response as people are pouring out their heart. Have you ever found yourself doing that? Someone's talking to you and in your mind, you're already starting to prepare the speech. Because I think that's what Job's friends are doing. Speeches seem already written before they've spoken them. Ask lots of questions. I think we're afraid of that sometimes, that we feel like that would be prying, but it shows our care, our concern, that we actually want to understand things. And do exactly as James 1:19 tells us, be quick to listen, be slow to speak, so that we'd be an encouragement and fulfill our duty to one another.